I said it last week, but I say it again. It just fascinates me that Dave and I are going from a series on several chapters of Matthew. It would take 17 weeks to do that, and now we're going to do the whole Bible in six. So we'll see how that goes. It's a bit of a shift, so to speak, and I'm looking forward to getting started again. It's so good to kind of relaunch the year and get into all the ministries, and I'm glad Dave brought up the idea that there's a place for you to serve as well, and we think it's so critical that everyone in the church finds a place to serve, a place to belong, not just Sundays, but beyond that as well. Today we're going to conclude this series on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. A picture 2,000 plus years ago, this obscure rabbi walking on the shores of a lake, and he began to call his disciples, "Follow me." And he calls various people. He called fishermen, he called a tax collector, others, simply with the call, "Follow me." Some did, some didn't. Maybe following for many was too hard. Exactly what did it mean to follow? And then Jesus preaches the Sermon on the Mount. "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." And he said, "Practice your relationship with God, prayer, fasting, giving. You know it's all from God anyway. And don't worry and don't judge. Live up to what you say. And let my words fill and my life fill your marriages and fill your relationships. And let my love be displayed even to your enemies. Choose each day life in me." Yeah, that's going to feel like the narrow way sometime, but it's the only way to life. And that life will grow in you. You'll see its fruit displayed in how you live. And this, Jesus says, this is what discipleship looks like. This is what it is to follow Jesus. And Jesus wants us to surely know that he is the way to life in all its fullness. And so we come to the very end of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7, and let's look at today's passage. You can follow along with me, or it's up on the screen here. "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine does not put them into practice is like the foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as the teachers of the law. I love verse 24 here, where Jesus says, put my words into practice. I think any pastor who has ever preached a sermon can relate to what Jesus says there. After delivering a good sermon, people will come and say, "Hey, that was a really good message, thank you," and it's really appreciated. But like Jesus, there's a voice inside of me at that point that says, "Please, please, don't just hear it. Don't just say, good pastor, good message, pastor. Go and live that stuff out. Apply it however you can to your life." And I think Jesus is, just like any good pastor, saying that's what needs to happen. These words actually have to make a difference in your life. Put these words into practice. Otherwise, they're just words. You read it in Luke 6:46, where Jesus says, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" Right? This Lord and doing thing, they belong together. Look at James elsewhere in Scripture. It says, "Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says, like someone who looks at his face in the mirror, after looking at himself, he goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they have heard, but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do." Don't deceive and delude yourself. Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is to be lived out. Notice both characters in this story that Jesus tells us, they both hear the word. This isn't a follower and then an unbeliever happening here. They are both doing stuff. They're both building. They both confess the Lord's teachings. They both hear Jesus' words. We might say they both read the Bibles. They both go to church. They both pretty much look the same. Unless you examine their foundations, and it'll take a storm to expose those foundations. I have a picture up here. Not a great picture, but this is the trip that a bunch of us went, a bunch of pastors and their spouses went on to Israel. And while we were there, and this is going to be hard for British Columbians to understand, but while they were there, a very shocking thing happened. It rained. And when it rains, it rains. And that water doesn't just seep into the soil and it's done. No. It runs all over the place. And this is the highway that those are our buses behind there. This is the highway that we were supposed to be driving down, but we couldn't, and a bunch of us got out and, took a look around, and those are, a bunch of fellow pastors there. And look at the next slide here. You can see the water rushing, right? I mean, this was, a heavy rainfall. It doesn't have anywhere really to kind of go. It's very dry. And then you see in that one picture beside the car, you see how fast the water's rushing. But you get a wadi. A wadi is a kind of a narrow area between the dried out mountain range there, and that water comes rushing down. The guy who led us on this trip, he said, in his take on this story, he said, the foolish man built his house on where a wadi was. And, then when the rain would come, and even though it rarely came, when it came, it would wash the whole house away. And that was his take on it. But it was just striking. And, I mean, this made the newspapers, right? This was big news while we were there. This didn't happen in 40, 50 years or something like that. So when we talk about this storm here, this is a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime kind of storm. And the point is this. The storm comes. Down poured that rain that rarely came. That the winds blew, the clouds burst. Small, dry creek beds are no longer small or dry. Waters rush by. The houses, and it takes the sand with them. Deeper and deeper it takes the sand away, and it exposes the foundation or lack thereof. And the one builder had dug past the sand to the bedrock. And Jesus calls him the wise builder versus the foolish builder. As modern readers, we tend to think of a wise person as possessing wisdom, sort of mixing it up with intellect in a sense. But in Jewish wisdom literature, the focus is always on the ways a wise person acts. For Matthew, the wise person is the one who responds properly to Jesus and his teachings, and he does something with them. Other examples of that, Matthew 25, another story Jesus told. At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like the 10 virgins who took their lamps, went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, 5 wise. Well, what's the difference? The foolish ones took their lamps, but didn't take any oil with them. The wise ones took oil in the jars along with their lamps. In other words, the wise ones were prepared to do something. They both responded to go to the wedding, but only 5 were prepared. I like this description of what a wise person might look like according to the Bible. Matthew 10:16. Jesus said, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. And there's this beautiful picture of a person living out wisdom. Fools disregard the foundation. They live in the moment. They fail to look ahead to when a storm might come. And I think we probably should add, and will come. It will come. And Jesus contrasts these two people and what they do. Each echoing this Jewish wisdom literature like Proverbs, where foolishness is always self-destructive. And I took 2 of these Proverbs, and you'll see that these were words Jesus was probably thinking on right here. Look at Proverbs 10:25. After the storm passes, the wrongdoers are blown away, but those who do right are safe and sound on the firm foundations forever. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Proverbs 12:7. The wrongdoers are overthrown. No one is left. But the house of the right living remains strong. And Jesus very likely was referring to this kind of proverb when he told this parable. And the people in the crowd would know those stories. And he says, once again, this would be what Jewish parents would say to their rebellious teenager. They'd kind of quote a proverb like that. The silly choices, the destructive choices you're making, they're foolish. They're like this foolish guy who builds his house on the bottom of a wadi where the floodwaters come. Don't be like that. So this would be that kind of phrase here. And Jesus is saying, a wise person doesn't just hear my words, he puts them into practice. He lives them. Dare we say he obeys them? Back to the choice of following Jesus. Let me tell you, Jesus never says become a Christian to anybody. That word Christian really wasn't much part of the vocabulary. But Jesus said many times, become a disciple, follow me. Some examples I just put down just to give you a refresher memory, Mark 8:34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves. Notice it's a doing thing. Take up their cross, follow me. John 13:35, by this everyone will know you are my disciples. How? If you love one another. We get to see it in action again. A disciple is one who follows and tries to live life like the one he follows. Now, don't get me wrong here. Being a disciple doesn't mean you're always a good disciple. Half the time when we look in the New Testament, half the time we see Jesus bawling out his disciples for being lousy disciples. Some things he said, oh, you of little faith. Or he said toward the end, near the crucifixion, could you not stay awake for 1 hour and pray with me? Or he said to one of his favorite disciples, you will deny me 3 times. Or he says at another point to his disciples, how long do I have to put up with you? Yeah, you know, they weren't always great disciples, but they were disciples. When I was in early elementary school, way back during the time of Moses, we had different reading groups, and I'm pretty sure they were named after a shape and a color. And we as little kids, it didn't take us long to figure out what the best reading group was, and I'm pretty sure that was a group kind of like, called like Blue Diamond Group. This group, we figured out really quickly, they were the much better readers than some of us who were red squares. You know, and at the time, you know, as kids, you always wanted them to be in that better reading group. But when I look back at it, I say, you know what? It really didn't matter. You're going to learn to read. Doesn't matter how long it takes. We're all becoming readers. And all those groups, I suspect all those kids I was in school with, all of us learned to read, however long it took us. In a sense, that's like disciples. They were following Jesus, albeit poorly at times. And when you follow, you attempt to do what he says. You attempt to obey. I hesitate with the word obedience because it has negative connotations in our day. I was a teacher for many, many years. Dealt with parents lots of times. And I know that if I had said something on a report card about your child is a leader, your child is a risk taker, or if I had added, your child is obedient, many parents would have preferred the first two. We have a sense that obedience is about being compliant, weak-willed, a conformist. This is not what Jesus is saying by the word obedient. He didn't say, I have come that you might be a weak-willed conformist. No, a disciple lives like Jesus. That's obedience. And she is someone who seeks to obey, yeah, with creativity and imagination and discernment and boldness. And out of that comes life. A life lived with humility and gentleness and self-control and joy and love and servanthood. someone who acts and looks a lot like Jesus. You become that good tree with all that wonderful fruit out of obedience. And Jesus simply invites us to choose life. It's not compliance. It's not about rules. No, it's the best way to live. Jesus, the author of life, says, follow me. I know what life looks like. Here, I'll describe it to you. Imagine you get selected to be part of the greatest team in the history of athletic competition. The coach is a strategic genius. He's a huge inspiration, and he's committed to you excelling. And he says, I want you to do these drills, watch these players, study this playbook, practice these exercises, and serve your teammates as they serve you. And you reply, well, you know, I really am interested in being on the team. I really do want to win a championship. But really, do I have to do all that? I'm not sure I have the time for all that. Pretty sure I can get by with some of that being left out. Let me ask you, how long would you last on that team? Right? I mean, that coach is going to say, listen, this is what it takes. This is what it looks like to build a championship team with championship players. Selective obedience will not bring the full life of being on the team. In AA's big book, they have this amazing quote that says this, half measures availed us nothing. Picture someone is addicted to whatever, and you can see lots and lots and lots and lots of half measures. Another quote out of the big book, we asked his protection and care, and then I love this phrase, with complete abandon. Complete surrender. There is no partial surrender. In our parable, the two build houses. You could replace the word house with life. Everyone is constructing something. Everyone. And we need to make a lot of choices in terms of our construction, about how we spend our time, how we speak, the words we use, what thoughts we dwell on, how we spend our money, what people will shape us, how we treat others. And you can try to put off the hard choices that you need to make and decisions that you'd rather not make. But there's a problem with that too, because not deciding becomes its own decision with its own consequences. That one stings me. Everybody is building, even when not deciding. There's no way to avoid this. You are building. The question is, what are you building? What are you building? There's no way to avoid that you are building. But what are you building? And another thought, everybody builds. Everybody faces storms. Everybody. This is not a story about storm avoidance. In life, there will be storms. Jesus says in John 16:33, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble. Take heart, I've overcome the world, but you will have trouble. Trouble shows up, storms come. And it's then that our foundation and the quality of our foundations get revealed. Everybody builds, everybody faces storms. And the variable here, what foundation are you building on? You will either build your life on the author of life, which makes complete sense, following him, living like him, with his grace. This is not about not needing grace. Or you will build your foundation on yourself, hoping you're stronger than the storms that show up. Half measures availed us nothing. Now my problem, maybe yours too, I often like half measures. I like a little surrender. I like a little devotion, a little generosity, a little self-denial. I'd like a little help from God when I need it, and then a little distance from Him when I want that too. And there's the choice between wise and foolish. Parents ask kids when they've done something stupid or destructive, why? What were you thinking? And you know the response, I don't know. I have no idea. It seemed like a good idea. And I picture Jesus here sitting looking at the guy's house laying flat there, and he says, why did you build on sand? And I see, I don't know. Seemed like the easiest way at the time. And it's just foolish. Nobody plans on getting a divorce or having an affair. Nobody plans to become greedy or a racist or self-centered. Nobody plans to go through life bitter and joyless. It just happens because of choices. So, we come to the book, end of the Sermon on the Mount. Rock, sand. Follow or not. Life, death. Every day. Luke 14, a little piece on discipleship here that I want to share with you out of the New Living Translation. Jesus says, if you do not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. But don't begin until you count the cost. For who would begin construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there's enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money, and then everyone would laugh at you, and they'd say, well, there's that person who started that building, couldn't afford to finish it. So you cannot be my disciple without giving up everything you own. With Jesus, there's no half measures. It's all of you. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a wonderful book with a great title called The Cost of Discipleship. Following Jesus, life, death, rock, sand, following Jesus will cost you. Surrender is always costly. What will it mean for you to surrender your will? What will it mean for you to surrender your ego? What will it mean for you to surrender your reputation, your resources, your pain, your desires? What will it mean? This may mean giving up a habit or giving up a relationship. This may mean loosening your grip on your money. This may mean making huge changes in how you live. You're always angry. You're always jealous. You're always bitter. You're always lazy. And this isn't about you gutting it out in your own strength. We all need grace all the time. But this is about Him being the foundational part of all of your life. There's no half measures here with Jesus. And then you arrange your life around practices and rhythms and relationships that are life-giving. And you need to constantly ask, will I follow this man as the Lord of my life? Or as Joshua said, choose this day, and start every day this way, choose this day whom you will serve, because you will serve something. We're going to have communion. It's kind of fitting to end the Sermon on the Mount at the table. I don't know if somebody's calling kids or not. I'm not sure how that's going right now. So I don't even know how that went today. I know, though, in my heart of hearts, for myself, and I know it for you too, that Jesus is the way of life. This is not about a one-time decision. This is about an everyday, every moment decision. Jesus is a way of living. And I know with all my heart that He cleanses me of all the stuff that robs me of life all the time. But He doesn't simply then just leave me there to make those same crummy choices again. No, He says, I want you to choose a whole lot better than that for the sake of life. To follow Him. To know Him. To be like Him. This leads me beyond worry and fear. I'm not saying that I don't get stuck there sometime. But there's something beyond worry, beyond fear. It isn't the end point. This takes me way beyond the slavery to desires. Way beyond me trying to find my safety in money or image or ego. This takes me beyond death itself. And so, when He looks me in the eyes and He says, follow me. And I want you to picture that right now. Christ taking your face in His hands, pulling your head up because maybe you're forcing yourself to look down because you don't want to look eye to eye with the author of life. And He takes your head and He lifts it up and He looks you in the eyes with passion and love and grace. And He says, follow me. Follow me. And I want to. And I'll do it. And I'll go where He leads. And I'll do what He says. And when I'm a lousy disciple, I'll seek His grace yet again, trusting yet again His power to cleanse this man.